History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, a quick note from Scott. This episode is a continuation of the series I've done with Steve Guerra called Hollywood Hates History, and we're going to be looking at the 1961 Sword and Sandals epic starring Charlton Heston, El Cid. And just a little bit of background about this movie. It takes place in 11th century Spain, which was a violent borderland of Christian-Muslim bloodshed. But what's interesting is that on the eve of the First Crusade, which starts in 1095, the two religions cooperated as much as they warred there. And hey, who else to capture the heart of medieval Spain than Charlton Heston himself? This movie is based on the real-life Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar, who lived from 1043 to 1099, and he was also the protagonist of the 13th century epic, The Poem of the Cid. Now, this movie captures medieval Spain in full Hollywood Golden Age splendor, as the long takes, a swelling musical score, and it notes the main points from Rodrigo's life, such as when he defeated the Muslim Almoravids in a decisive battle in the history of Spain's Reconquista. But what's interesting is that I would argue the movie does a really good job of capturing this age. It shows the interreligious conflict, but also cooperation that was happening, and all of the royal politics that makes this place sort of a Game of Thrones-esque type of setting. And the dialogue in the movie can be kind of cheesy and border on the mythopoetic, but I'd say that Charlton Heston does a much better job handling it than John Wayne did as Genghis Khan. So this is a really fun movie to look at, and there's a lot of history to unpack here as well, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Steve Guerra on the movie El Cid. Hello, listeners. Welcome to the special series that I have done with the one and only Steve Guerra on Hollywood Hates History. Steve, are you ready to watch a true gem of a film?
Oh, I am more than ready. More than ready. This one is very special.
Oh, yeah. So this was at Steve's suggestion. We're going to watch the 1961 Charlton Heston movie, El Cid. And I've got to say, I was a little bit surprised because we've watched a lot of John Wayne movies in the series. We've watched a Vietnam film. What was that one called?
Oh, The Green Beret.
That's it. We watched the truly remarkable film, The Conqueror, John Wayne and the role he was born not to play, Genghis Khan. And what I was surprised by is, like, Charlton Heston, he has a lot in common with John Wayne, and I guess a lot of Golden Age film actors, where you don't disappear into the role disappears into you. Charlton Heston, whether he's on the Planet of the Apes, whether he's telling people that Soil and Green is made out of people, whether he's battling zombies as the Omega Man, whether he's Moses leading the Israelites across the Red Sea, he is Charlton Heston. But it might be just me, but it works for Charlton Heston in a way that it doesn't for John Wayne.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but maybe he's larger than life. Maybe John Wayne is so identified with the Western genre that you just imagine him saying howdy pilgrim, even if he's being Genghis Khan. But Charlton Heston can be Charlton Heston in wildly different contexts. So I don't know.
It really does work. And he really is. Charlton Heston is a font that I can't believe we haven't tapped into. He's done probably about a dozen of these sword and sandal epics. And like you said, it's something with his personality or his Charlton Heston's acting style that you never say, oh man, it's just Charlton Heston being Charlton Heston. There's always a thin veneer of a character on top of him that just makes it much more enjoyable than John Wayne.
Yeah, I think when we get into this movie, now this is a Golden Age film, and the sword and sandals, when characters speak, they speak in a mythopoetic kind of way that you would find in the Odyssey or the Iliad. John Wayne did this in The Conqueror, where he says, "I do not believe your words, Tatar woman." That sounds horrible and ridiculous. But when Charlton Heston does it, or a character in proximity to him, I believe it in a different way. Listeners will love or hate this analogy, but I'm a fan of Jason Statham. I think he's one of the greatest B-movie actors out there. If you don't know him, he's a bald British man who fights a lot of people. And he was in the Transporter trilogy. When he says lines that are funny but stupid, I believe them when Jason Statham said it. And they tried to reboot the Transporter franchise with an actor from Game of Thrones and Ed Skrein or something like that. And he tried to do Jason Statham lines, but it just didn't work in the same way. I didn't believe it was a stupid line, but said it would be said with charm by Jason Statham, but it doesn't work with others. And Charlton Heston is sort of that, where he can pull off the mythopoetic in a way that John Wayne can't. So anyway, that's how we start off at the top of El Cid. What do you think, Steve? Anything else before we get into the meat of the movie?
Yeah, I think that that's the real, these movies, these gigantic epics are very much of a time. They start in about the 50s, they go into the 60s, maybe stretching out with a couple of Charlton Heston movies into the early 70s, and they're very theatrical, and I believe that they were filmed in a very theatrical way, where the way they zoom in on certain characters, they're not going for a more realistic view and a realistic shooting, and like the sets are very over the top, which if you ever watch, go and watch El Cid, they're very elaborate sets, and they don't try for historical accuracy at all. They're really showing, they're epic movies. Another Charlton Heston movie of the Ten Commandments, you get that epic nature. They're not going realistic at all.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you don't have the benefit of CGI, and every scene is basically filmed in the desert of Southern California. That's how you had to get things done back in the 60s, because that's how Hollywood worked. But the advantage is you can have a cast of hundreds or thousands. You have a cast of thousands on horseback. You get something that, I mean, if it were a modern movie, they'd probably have 10 guys on horseback and then CGI and multiply it by 10 and use all that. And the uncanny valley would kick in. It doesn't quite feel realistic, but you have these huge sweeping sets and everything. Well, anyway, so that's a filmmaking side of things. But to open up the history, I sort of have to do a Russian nesting doll here, because I'm talking about a real historical figure, Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar, who, El Cid, he is a real person who lived from 1043 to 1099. But first I have to talk the history of the actual person, and then I have to talk about the poem of the Cid, which is an epic that probably dates to around the 1200s, and it has similarities to other medieval epics like the Song of Roland. And then we have to talk about the movie that is sort of based on the poem, but also takes on its own elements. So you have to ask, okay, is the film trying to base things on a poem, which isn't historically accurate, or the real history of him? So I'll do my best to bounce around between them and pick up from there. Basically, the poem and the movie take place in late 11th century Spain. This is a few centuries into the, you could say, Muslim occupation, but when Muslims enter Spain in 711, it's a few centuries in there. This is after the Muslims really lose power in Spain. The Umayyad Caliphate, the independent caliphate, reigns there, but they really don't have the centralized control. There's a lot of independent Muslim states in Iberia. So this is after consolidated Muslim control, but it's before the Spanish Reconquista really picks up steam and the Crusader spirit is infusing Europe in the 1100s and 1200s. Spain is a pretty wild borderland at this time. So in the epic, the poem of the Cid, what happens is that Rodrigo marries the cousin of King Alfonso VI, Doña Ximena. Is that what she's called in the movie? Sofia Loren.
They call her, they different characters call her different things. They call her Shemaine. Charlton Heston doesn't really keep one of those consistent throughout the entire film either. But her name's Ximena in Spanish. It's not that complicated of a name to say. And I think they use the X spelling in her name instead of a J. That was just a spelling convention in northern Spain. So I don't know where they got that pronunciation from, but as far as I know, her name was just Ximena.
Okay, well, we'll do that. But like you said, the movie is all over the place. And the notes were, wait, what's her name again? But it's Sofia Loren in the early 60s at her most smoky Italian sultriness in her career.
Oh, yeah, turned up to 10.
And she also knows how to stare death daggers at Charlton Heston when the scene calls for it. So all sorts of things going on in this movie. It succeeds in many ways. But so to very briefly sum up the epic, Rodrigo marries Ximena, the cousin of King Alfonso VI. But due to various circumstances, he falls into the disfavor of the king and has to leave his home country of Castile. To regain his honor, he participates in battles against the Moorish armies, what they refer to the Muslims there. He conquers the city kingdom of Valencia. And with these heroic acts, he regains the confidence of the king. His honor is restored. Then the king, he personally arranges the weddings of El Cid's daughters to the princes of Carrion. But when the princes are humiliated by El Cid's men for their cowardice, they swear revenge. They beat their new wives and leave them for dead. And then when El Cid learns of this, he pleads to the king for justice. And the princes are forced to return El Cid's dowry and are defeated in a duel, and they're stripped of honor. And then El Cid's two daughters remarry to the crown princes of Navarre and Aragon. And through these marriages of his daughters, El Cid begins to unify. It's a theme in a lot of these different medieval epics. In Dante's Inferno, there are ideas of the unification of Italy. Spain has these similar ideas too. So that's the poem. So hopping back to the real Rodrigo, he did reclaim the city of Valencia from Moorish control for a brief period of time during the Reconquista. He actually carves out an independent lordship of Valencia from 1094 until 1099. And his wife inherits the city and maintains it until 1102 when it is reconquered by the Moors. And he's known for his service in the armies of both Christian and Muslim rulers. So anyway, that's the poem. That's the real Rodrigo. So shall we take a look at the movie?
Oh, boy. Yeah, we okay. Sure. I suppose we should. That's what we're here for.
I guess so. So the movie starts. There's a Spanish village burning and Rodrigo Diaz rescues it on the way to his wedding with Jimena, and he captures the emirs Al-Mutamin and Al-Qadir of Valencia, two men in, I presume, brown face. That's Hollywood in the early 60s. So the villagers want them to be hanged, but Rodrigo, he releases them on the pledge not to attack Ferdinand of Castile, the sovereign of Rodrigo. And the Al-Mutamin, he pledges friendship to whom he calls him El Cid, which is in Arabic means Al-Sidi or Lord. And then this is one of the wonderful mythopoetic lines in the movie where a priest says, "You did take the shortest road, not to your bride, but to your destiny. God has sent you, my son." So I'll say this, like that's an accurate thing in the movie where there's a lot of collaboration and fraternization between Muslims and Christians, which in the 11th century is true. It's sort of like the good Christians and the good Muslims are fighting against the really bad Muslim, the Almoravids from North Africa, which were pretty harsh rulers. And Bin Yusuf, although he's called Ben Yusuf in the movie, exemplifies that. But if this were a modern movie, I can imagine clergy being upset that Rodrigo is talking with Muslims and a fat bishop shaking his fist and going, "El Cid, I'll get you and your Muslim fraternization." Yeah. Well, we'll get to this later on the movie about Christian-Muslim relations at the time because it's interesting and very different from later centuries, to be sure. So there's a lot of intrigue. It's court politics. I'll do my best to kind of hammer this out, listeners. But so for not hanging these emirs, Rodrigo El Cid, same guy, he's charged with treason by Count Gormaz, the king's champion, and Jimena's father. Gormaz insults Rodrigo's father. Rodrigo fights a duel on his father's behalf and kills Gormaz, and Jimena swears to avenge him. If this were a modern movie, it would be like the Marvel Cinematic Universe where they're always winking at the crowd, how ridiculous it is, but it takes itself seriously like Mad Max Fury Road. So the King of Aragon then challenges the King of Castile for another city that they're squabbling over. And Rodrigo, to sort of clear his name and regain his honor, he challenges the champion of Aragon on behalf of Castile, and this is sort of an ordeal for his innocence against treason, that if I lose, that proves I'm guilty. If I win, then I stand before God as being innocent. Cid wins. He becomes Castile's champion, but Jimena is staring daggers this whole time at him and still wants vengeance for the death of her father. She stares daggers at him for about a good 40 or 50 minutes of the film. Then Rodrigo is sent to collect tribute from a Muslim vassal, and he asks that Jimena be given to him on his return as a wife. So another count secretly wants to marry her and plans an ambush, but they are saved from this ambush by Al-Mutamin, so that Rodrigo's mercy pays off for him there. He then weds Jimena but is so icy. So they do not consummate their marriage, and she goes to stay temporarily at a convent. Kind of like where the royal squabbling gets in is that King Ferdinand dies. The Alfonso, the younger son, tells the older son that the father wanted to split up the kingdom and divide it among them and their sister, Urraca. But Alfonso wants a real united kingdom. So they fight. Sancho sends Alfonso to be imprisoned. And then what happens is, like, the real villain, the real heavy of this movie is the Almoravid leader, Ibn Yusuf. He plans an invasion of Spain. He sees, like, this division in the kingdom of Castile. And at one point, he kind of gives his mustache-twirling villain monologue where he says, "I will conquer Spain and then conquer Europe and conquer the world." which it's wonderful balderdash, but I'll get into this more later. But part of why El Cid is important today, and he was significant throughout history, is he's seen as this person who sort of saved Christendom. But a lot of these battles were regional battles that just so happened to be on the frontier of quote unquote Christendom or the Muslim world. And later on, we see that they were the high tide of this particular religion's spread, and then it receded. But on the ground at the time, people didn't understand it in this way. They thought, okay, this is a principality I can take, and, you know, here's an opportunity to go do that. So this Almoravid leader, Ibn Yusuf, he hires a Spanish warrior to assassinate Sancho and pin the blame on Alfonso. And El Cid thinks that this did happen, that Alfonso did have him assassinated. So Alfonso banishes him from Spain, and then Ximena forgives him and joins him. So at this time, Rodrigo sort of, he's an independent knight. His legend as a foreign soldier spreads. He fights for Christians. He fights for Muslims. A whole bunch of knights rally to him. Alfonso fears him. It's kind of like Prince John and the Robin Hood myth. But he eventually calls on Rodrigo to fight for him when he sees a threat of Yusuf. What Rodrigo wants to do is to take the coastal city of Valencia, because I think if we have this, it's right on the coast. We can prevent Yusuf's attack. They're going to come by sea and their amphibious assault. So they hold Valencia. They perform a siege. Locals are starving. The Muslim ruler Al-Qadir, who at the beginning of the film promised to Rodrigo that he wouldn't fight him, but he does. So he's bad. He's living all fat and happy in his harem, living large while the people in his city are starving. El Cid, because he and his knights are good, they load their catapults with bread and send them over the walls and call on people to turn on their leaders, which they do. And so Rodrigo wins Valencia. He's offered the crown, but he refuses it and claims it for Alfonso in Valencia, which he does accept the crown in real life. The Muslim warriors wear turbans and black robes, which is fun anachronism, but, you know, it's old Hollywood. So Ibn Yusuf's army comes. The two armies rush each other on the beach, and old Golden Age Hollywood movies and today's movies, I guess, never believe in military formations. It's always wild melee combat where two sides just rush each other and fence. Cid is shot with an arrow. He returns to the safety of the walls, but he calls for an attack the next day, and his physician says, "You know, I could take this arrow out now and you'll live, but it'll take some time to recover, or I leave it in and you won't be knocked out like the way you would if I took out the arrow, but you're going to die." So he knows that he needs to lead the attack, so he's sort of holstered up into his horse. He's led and he's joined by Alfonso and Al-Mutamin, and they ride out against Ibn Yusuf. Ibn Yusuf is personally trampled by a horse, and King Alfonso leads Christians and Moors alike in prayer for God to receive the soul of the purest knight of all. So that's my quick rundown of El Cid. Anything else there, Steve?
And then the end, El Cid literally rides off in the sunset down the beach, dead in his saddle, holding his banner, and he just rides down the beach.
I mean, there's some movies where you can have subtlety, but this is not one of those movies. What's the point at this point?
No, it is not.
All right. Well, yeah, that's a movie. So what's your take on, I don't know, the what you thought was good?
I think that in a lot of ways, the movie caught certain elements of what was going on in medieval Spain in the middle of the 1000s. It's weird. It got a lot of the events right, but just in no particular order. They kind of mixed them all up throughout the entire movie. They were playing with the idea of the convivencia and the Christians and the Muslims really got along. And it was just kind of like these extreme end of the Muslims with the Ben Youssef and the extremes of the Catholics, but everybody else more or less got along. They played with it, but they didn't bring it to its fruition. And maybe that's something that if they had made this movie today, they would have either done it better or done it in a more ham-fisted fashion. You don't really know which way they would have gone with it.
Yeah, I think they would have gone as likely Kingdom of Heaven, which, listeners, if you want to go back in the archives, you can hear how much Steve and I love that movie and thought it was historically accurate and really honored the medieval mindset and how people would have thought and behaved back then. Just nails it perfectly in every way. Hey, everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. When I was thinking about this movie, because I took in my graduate program, I took a seminar on borderlands, specifically Islamic borderlands. And that was a huge hobby horse of my professor because that's what his research is on. So we looked at histories of different areas, whether it's the Byzantine Arab frontier, the medieval Spain, or the Ottoman frontiers. And what's interesting is that the Epic of El Cid, it has a lot in common with, let's say, Persian warrior epics written in the 11th or 12th century, where there's combat among Christians, among Muslims, or even early biographies of Muhammad, where a lot of times you'll have characters who are of a different religion. Maybe it's a Christian monk who recognizes the holy office of Muhammad, or Christian warriors who join the banner of a Persian mercenary who's fighting Christians, but also fighting other Muslims. So this seems to be a stock theme in a lot of these epics that you can sort of cross religious boundaries by recognizing the nobility and bravery of somebody. And that's present here in this as well. So, and I'll say too that that's something that is, I would say, is historically accurate, because what's happening in Spain in the 11th century is, to really get things done, you have to work across religious lines. That Muslim power really doesn't break in Spain completely. It's much weaker in the 1000s than it was in, say, the 800s or 900s, to be sure. But it doesn't really break until Alfonso VIII's victory over the Almohads in 1212. And we're dealing with Alfonso VI in this movie. And with the Crusades happening, you start to get papal endorsement for Spanish battles against Muslims in the 12th and 13th centuries. And in 1214, the Pope would even excommunicate Christians fighting with Muslims. But you're still going to have tons of mercenaries out there. And plenty of people, if you were with the Almoravid Caliphate collapsing in the 1000s, they were always looking for mercenaries for military muscle. And there were tons of Christian Muslim alliances in the 10th and 11th centuries that maybe wouldn't have been possible later on. So great opportunities if you're a soldier of fortune, if you're fighting literally free lance. And so, I mean, really, the name of the game, even if you're threatened with an excommunication, you wanted wealth, you wanted status, and you wanted power. So that's how you could do this. And I think that the hopping of religious boundaries was something that was a reality then. And I think it was it Pope Gregory? Like, he calls for a crusade in the 1070s against the Muslims in Spain, but nobody really answers it, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah. Right. So that shows now tons of people answer the call for the first crusade, but it's not really about fighting Muslims. And we talked about this with Kingdom of Heaven. It's for what holy relics meant at the time and for reclaiming the Holy Land. And it was almost incidental that it happened to be occupied by Muslims, because it had been occupied since the 600s. So that really wasn't the root cause, much as there was a call to fight Muslims in the 1070s. No one really cared. But with the Crusader spirit fusing, filling up Europe in the 1100s, 1200s, then the nature of Christian-Muslim combat starts to change over time. So that was one aspect there. But yeah, any other thoughts on what you liked? I have a lot more to say, but curious on your take.
It was a really strange time that Spain, not too long before that, the Iberian Peninsula, the Christians were super fragmented. There was Asturias, Navarre, Aragon, Leon, and they would, like, sometimes one would absorb another, but they were all pretty much a mess. And the Muslim part of Spain was kind of one political unit, and it was around the year 1000 or right about this time of El Cid, and when all of the Muslim, that kingdom broke up into a whole bunch of different sub-kingdoms, taifas, I think they called them. And that's really what gave the Christians in the north the impetus, because it was kind of like playing medieval total war, where if you took the capital of one of these taifas, then you took the whole area around it. So Valencia was really far away from Christian control, but it was one sub-Muslim kingdom. And when Rodrigo was able to take that one city, then, you know, that whole province on the map turned from orange to purple, like in the video game. And I think that part of it is there was a historiographic that the Christians were the underdogs at this point, but at this point they're starting to be more in control, and the Muslim kingdoms in the south needed their military muscle to fight all their squabbling amongst themselves. And it's kind of a, and then the Almohads, the Almoravids, or
Almoravids, yeah.
The Almoravids, they come in, and once they come in, they make a mess of it, because those Taifa Muslim states don't particularly love that the Almoravids have come in.
The history of Muslim Spain, it's interesting. It begins as an extension in 711. It's sort of a emirate of the at the time, there's the Abbasid Caliphate, but one of the princes of the Umayyad Caliphate, which was taken over by the Abbas dynasty when the control of the caliphate changed hands, he went to Spain. So sort of like the last outpost of the Umayyad dynasty is in Spain. So when we talk about the golden age of medieval Islam, when they have more consolidated control, it's around this time. The Almoravids are Berbers from North Africa, and when they come into power later on, this is centuries after the initial Muslim conquest of Spain, like you said, they're not particularly liked. They rule people in a more heavy-handed way. They're sort of the Assyrian Empire of Mesopotamia, in that they have more of a reputation for cruelty. So they can't really keep a unified rule in the same way. But even with the breaking of power of unified Islamic Spain, it still takes centuries for that Reconquista to complete. And I think that this time period is it's washed over because of looking at things through the lens of 1492 and the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of Moors out of Spain and the expulsion of Jews as well. So there's whole communities in North Africa of Muslims from Spain who are expelled there. There's also Moorish communities in Constantinople that are linguistically and ethnically distinct in the city for probably a century or two afterwards. And even the Jewish population speak Sephardic, which is Spanish with different Hebrew influences, and they maintain a distinct community in the Ottoman Empire as well. But that projection backwards of the Spanish Inquisition, I think it papers over this time where there are a lot of freebooters, where somebody like Rodrigo, what actually happens in his life when he does have a falling out with Alfonso, he's able to, when he gains control over Valencia, Al-Qadir is his tributary. So he does cooperate with Muslims significantly, and his final years are spent fighting the Almoravid Berbers, and he gives them their first major defeat in 1094. So that's why he's well known. So he's a Christian hero, but he's one who also cooperates heavily with other Muslims at the time. And yeah, seems like the movie, as much as possible, seemed to get this part right.
Yeah, they also got it kind of right with when Ferdinand died and he split his kingdom up. And he just announced that he was going to split his kingdom up. And Sancho, the oldest son, expected to get all of Ferdinand. I think he pretty much controlled everything in the north except for Navarre and maybe one other place. And the Spanish didn't use strict primogeniture like a lot of other places, because I think even that might be backdating a little bit, but that wasn't entirely the norm in that part of the Middle Ages, that the king passed on all of his lands to his son.
Right. And this is where I'm getting out of my realm of expertise, Neither one of us are medievalists. I could say more about the Ottoman context. It also didn't practice primogeniture, but it did practice fratricide, where the sultan who claimed the throne would kill his brothers. So you don't have situations like you have in this movie, which make European medieval politics so messy but so fascinating to study.
That was a big problem that the Spanish had for the next 100 years, and probably why the Reconquista, if you will, took so long, is that the kings would split their power and these kingdoms would combine and split again and combine and split again. And they never really were able to gather up as many resources as they could have. I think Ferdinand, he split the kingdom up between his three sons. Castile went to Sancho. Alfonso got something, another brother got something, but then there was two daughters, and they talked about the one daughter, Urraca. Yeah. She was kind of like the bad woman of the movie, kind of the bad movie. I had a hard time getting a read on her, but so Ferdinand gave them his two daughters. They didn't get like a full kingdom, but they got two stronghold cities inside of those kingdoms. So like, he either thought that this would miraculously cause like a balance of powers or a complete disaster. Who knows when somebody splits things up, if that's what they really want, is a complete disaster.
Right. And there's stronger reason to believe that Alfonso wasn't innocent, but I suppose that gets into some ideas on how to make the film better, because I had a few ideas there along these lines. But anything else about what you liked before we get into that?
Things that I like, I guess like is a strong word in this context, but I'd have to say I kind of liked the choreography of the fight scenes, even though they were all together far too long.
Yes.
I mean, they really did do a good job. I mean, I don't think they were basically fencing matches. So they must have done a lot of work to train them to do those kinds of really intricate fight scenes that are totally unrealistic, but it's fun, almost beautiful to watch.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. In that first scene where Rodrigo or El Cid, he's fighting the champion of Castile, it goes on forever. But I thought, all right, there's some wide shots here. You can see that's really Charlton Heston with a sword. Nowadays, we make a big deal if Tom Cruise or Keanu Reeves are actually doing their own stunts. But the expectation is something like, when Liam Neeson is in Taken 4 or Taken 5 or whatever thing he's doing, where he's a man in his late 50s, early 60s, however old he is. And whenever the scene requires him to do something like jumping or bend at the waist or run, it cuts. And it's very clear the stunt double is being pushed in. And listeners, if you want to see something real, extreme example of this, apparently Steven Seagal is taking advantage of his twilight years as a celebrity and doing a lot of direct-to-video action movies. And there are YouTube clips that show the climactic fight of the scene where it's horribly stitched together editing, where Steven Seagal, who's very overweight, is lumbering towards someone. And then it'll cut and there's basically a silhouette of someone doing martial arts fighting, and then it cuts to a close-up of his face. So Charlton Heston didn't do that. He actually filmed his own fight scene. So good for you, Charlton Heston.
Yeah, there's a YouTube channel of the guy who trains the good ones, like I guess Keanu Reeves in the John Wick movies, he did everything. And they said that in a lot of those fight scenes and like his gunplay was so good, they had to train him to slow down. Whereas opposed with the Bourne movies with Matt Damon, it was all close in shots and like hands and feet moving because he just couldn't do those moves.
So something to be said for, you know, good old fashioned Hollywood craftsmanship. So, yeah, I guess, I mean, we can discuss some things that could be better. Number one, I mean, can anyone just film a historically accurate battle scene? We have cavalry charges for a reason, people. Lining up all your horses together, it's a force multiplier. I mean, we've understood force multiplying at least since the phalanx, where you don't just have two armies rush each other with melee combat. But if you march in a row and push with your shields and your spears and other things like that, you're a lot more effective. It's true if you're an infantryman. It's true if you're on a horse. I mean, is there something from a director's standpoint that just doesn't look as good on camera as two armies just running at each other and hacking each other to bits? Am I missing something here? Am I taking crazy pills?
Yeah, it's basically they have to have that choreographed fencing match with one-on-one, which is absolute chaos. And one horseman could just start hacking at everybody. Like, they never explain that. Like, when the horses just suddenly come out of nowhere, how do they know who to hack at when everybody's dressed essentially the same? Like you said, the directors must just love the melee scene.
I mean, maybe it looks better on camera. I don't know. But that's a little quibble. I don't know. The other thing is that, as far as we know from the historical Alfonso, there's strong reason to believe that he really did get his brother Sancho killed. He wasn't framed for it the way the movie does by Bin Yusuf. So I thought, I don't know, why not lean into that? Like, Alfonso is already kind of a sniveling character. Like, just make him a full all-out Prince John, like Robin Hood, where people love El Cid. They're looking for a real hero. I mean, why not just go that way? Maybe it's because Alfonso continued to rule that you couldn't quite take that tack. So you have to leave him more redeemable, but set him up in opposition to El Cid. So they're trying to strike that balance. They thought, well, let's just project all of our villainy all onto Bin Yusuf, who has plans of world domination. Even though, like I was saying, at this, what, excuse me, whether it's this or whether it's the Battle of Tours in 732, where Charles Martel of France checks the Umayyad advance, that was much more likely just a raiding party that he defeated rather than a battle of world historical significance. But projected backward, that's how we choose to see these things, even though at the time, that's not how it was understood. So I don't know. From a cinematic standpoint, I don't know if it makes the movie better, but that's at least a quibble to point out.
I think the big problem that the movie had, and they really didn't ever figure out a way to iron it out, is just the historical story. There's a lot of main characters involved. There's not a lot of side characters. Urraca has a lot to play. Ximena has a lot to play. Rodrigo, like, there's six or seven people. Ben Yusuf, there's the Taifa commanders. And instead of picking maybe two or three of them to zoom in on, they picked everyone. And so that's why it seemed like they had to just keep jumping around from one thing to the next. And I never really understood what they were really trying to get with the whole thing with Sophia Loren Ximena. She hates him. She loves him. She hates him. She loves him. They never played that out completely. And I almost think, like, they had to have a love story. Why not just say that she's his girlfriend? And then they could have focused in on some of the other stuff a lot better. It's not like they were really holding fast and true to historical accuracy.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of funny that if you're going to get into courtroom drama, I mean, that of course can be made very interesting, but you really have to have it be at least a miniseries or something like Game of Thrones, where it goes on multiple seasons to see how all these conspiracy and plots play out. Because when you have a lot of characters, you can get lost in it. The great sword and sandals epics like the Ben-Hur or more modern Gladiator, it really focuses on one main character. They have one villain, and you'll have other peripheral characters too, but you really don't have to focus on them too much, so you don't get lost in everything that's going on. When you try to have both of a sword and sandals epic, but then a bunch of court politics, that's where things can get a little bit confusing. So, I mean, perhaps for the sake of simplicity, yeah, pare it down. Either make Bin Yusuf the great villain or Alfonso. Yeah, I mean, you can have it both ways. So, and I guess they're trying to do justice to the character of El Cid, that in this messy context where alliances are fragile, really all you can depend on is honor, and you never know where you'll find friendship of someone who you showed mercy to. Maybe that's what they're trying to say there. But for the faults there, it does work better than John Wayne as Genghis Khan. So I think that's something that we can't forget in this discussion.
Then they also get the perfect thing at the end, where Charlton Heston always seems to have to die in these movies, even though El Cid doesn't die. He didn't die until after the fall of Valencia, and they don't really save. He kind of saves Valencia, but he doesn't die dramatically. I think he's just old and he dies. There's no dramatic ending for El Cid, which that doesn't fly in a Charlton Heston movie.
Yeah, I remember that from when I saw this in my high school Spanish class, of hoisting him up, deceased, to his horse, and he rides out. In the epic poem as well, he is also an elderly man, and he marries off his daughters to consolidate the royal line of Spain and lead to its ultimate consolidation and its power status. So I guess they needed something like that to show that he's in the mythopoetic scheme of the film, that's a great way to send him off. So that's, I guess, what they're trying to go for there. So that's a take on it. But overall, I think that it succeeds in a lot of the larger themes, even though it gets some of the smaller details incorrect, for capturing the spirit of what 11th century Spain would have been like and how you would do well there. I have to say, I think it does pretty well.
I mean, my quibbles are mostly with that I think probably maybe back in the 60s, it was highly entertaining, and that's really what the market was asking for. I think it doesn't quite carry it through today. And I think what you were saying is that a mini series, and Amazon Prime just started releasing a mini series on El Cid that they made in Spain. And it's got problems. There's definitely problems with it. But I think it was much better able to, over the course of 5 episodes in a season, 5-hour episodes, lay out and build up a little bit more of a personality. In this movie, you just don't really get to know Alfonso very much. You don't really get to know any of the characters, even though the movie's pushing 3 hours long. They never really built anybody's personalities, and that even Rodrigo, who's in just about every scene, you don't really get to know who he's, a lot of what his motivation is. And I think that was the main issue that I had with the movie, is you get kind of a flimsy understanding of 11th century Spain. You get a flimsy understanding of all these interesting characters, and a lot of wide shots of many, many wide shots of fight scenes of Southern California. I think they did film a little bit of it in Spain, but that's another thing, is this is high Franco Spain too, which was not the most pleasant place. I think they did film some spaghetti westerns in Spain, because a lot of Spain looks kind of like the American West, and it was very cheap to film in Spain at that time.
Okay, so that's a good point there, that it's a, maybe Franco made some concessions there for the national hero to get his due in film. And listeners, that is a good point here, that maybe something we didn't capture in our discussion is, if you haven't seen a lot of Golden Age films, the pacing is much slower. So when we were talking about this beforehand, I could imagine an editor cutting 10 seconds out of a slow panning shot, or when someone is on horseback. A modern movie would show 2 seconds of someone coming over hill, and then it would cut to a close-up of him. Here, oh no, you get the, he comes over, and then a good 15 or 20 seconds as he comes closer to the camera. So it's nearly 3 hours long. You really take in a lot of it. So if you watch it on 1.5 speed, if you can, you'll, I think, be able to get the gist of the film. That's for sure. And like you said, there's not development, because who needs development when you're already an archetype to begin with? Where, that's a good point. I don't think El Cid undergoes any character development whatsoever in the movie. He is born as El Cid, and then he just goes through a series of trials. But he is an archetype. He is Charlton Heston through and through, from first scene to last scene. All right. Well, that is our discussion of El Cid. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode in our series of Hollywood Hates History. All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.